Well, ladies and gentlemen, welcome. Thank you so much for tuning in here. Henrik with Red Ice TV. Always a pleasure having you with us. Hope you're having a wonderful Thursday. What is it? Thursday, the April 25th already, if you can believe that, heading into May. Great to have you all with us. If you're joining us here on the Thursday evening, or if you're joining us later in the archives. Anyway, great to have you here. Today we have Mark Brahman on the show, who I've, whose work I've known about for some time now, but I've actually not have him on the show yet. So it's good to have you here, Mark. Thank you for coming on with us.
Yeah, well, certainly the pleasure is all mine. I've been aware of your work for a long time, of course, as has everyone really in the alt-right. So, and you guys do spectacular work, both you and Lana. So I've been a longtime fan. Yeah, it's a great. I mean, we actually met in person at one point, and it was a pleasure meeting you in person as well.
Same, same, exactly. And I can't believe it took this long, but here you go. Better later than never, as I say. So it's good to have you here. And I'm looking forward to, you know, diving into some of your material today, especially in regards to the Apollonian transmission. I you know, it's good to start at the beginning, I guess, and you can introduce, you know, yourself, whatever you feel is pertinent to mention about yourself to the audience who might not you know, I've heard about your work before, but I want to get into basically when you started the website, you know, kind of how you ended up on this track and what caused you to move in that direction. So give us a little bit of some background on yourself if you want to.
Yeah, yeah. I exactly when I started the website, maybe I started it like 6 months ago. I can't remember exactly when that occurred. I mean, I'll describe kind of the origin of the work that I'm publishing on that website. And effectively, it all kind of started in a very kind of circuitous way. You know, I've had a kind of lifelong interest in mythology, and particularly European mythology, of course. And my interest primarily was an interest as an artist. You know, I was interested in developing fiction works and even, you know, swords and sorcery fantasy works and those sort of things. And I think I had always been aware, you know, that there was going to be a kind of underlying sort of pro-white, you know, perspective to these works, that would be kind of esoterically conveyed in the works, you know, through the use of symbol and language. And so that kind of, gave me a very good perspective, I think, to do the work that I'm engaged in now, in the sense that when an artist is creating a work, he's looking for names for characters. He's looking for kind of symbolically meaningful names for characters. He's looking for kind of symbols to use, and he's very interested in kind of the actual meaning of these symbols. And that leads him to a study of mythology, right? And mythology had always just generally been a kind of lifelong interest of mine. So what happened from there is that, you know, the alt-right started to gain steam, and, you know, Richard was, Spencer was publishing at, Radix, and I had an interest in maybe like tapping into the alt-right, audience as a fiction writer. Now this is, I got kind of very distracted from that path, as it would turn out, but excuse me. What would happen from there is that, I started writing sort of, analysis of cinema. And I think my first article was an article on Steven Spielberg's, AI, his film AI. And that was, that film was a very interesting film, and I submitted it to Radix, and Richard was very interested in that as well, because it was a kind of heavily encoded film that was using symbol in a very sophisticated way. And it's written from a Jewish perspective, right? In a kind of, triumphalist Jewish perspective, in the sense, you know, I'll just kind of spoil the movie for the audience, but kind of the sort of hidden message in the film is that, the robots in the film, you know, especially represented by this central robot, are kind of metaphorically Jews. And what happens in the kind of denouement of the film is that the rest of the human race goes extinct, but, you know, this sort of Jewish robots triumph at the end of the film. So it was a kind of remarkable and very kind of, striking and spectacular use of what I would eventually call Jewish esoteric moralization. Now that's a term I've developed to describe, Jewish esoteric messages appearing in Jewish works of art, in cinema, in, comic books. And so what I did was that from there, you know, and that was fun. I mean, that was kind of really, my interest was really not in studying Jewish artists originally, you know, for a number of reasons people on the alt-right might understand. It's just like, I'd rather kind of, you know, produce my Aryan art, as it were, right? And not worry about what these guys are up to and not really care. But it actually turned out to be an extremely kind of fruitful path that I pursued after that. Because as it turns out, and I think that this is a sort of kind of, this will, in a way, I think that we will eventually kind of develop a kind of renewed respect for Jews as symbolists, because they're actually very kind of sophisticated symbolists, as it turns out. I started studying Jewish art, especially Jewish cinema, and then Jewish comic books. And eventually Richard and I decided, and this was kind of, I kind of got off the path here, but it ended up being an extremely kind of fruitful and useful path. I started writing a book on comic books, originally just focusing on the Spider-Man parables. In this study, I realized that it's not just the case that Jews are kind of like sort of skilled symbolists in art, that they're kind of drawing from a common symbol language, as it were, right? So that they're using a kind of common symbol language. And I was starting to kind of decipher this symbol language. And I was like, you know what? I should just do all the comic books that were made from like 1933 and I brought it up to 1966, which is kind of toward the end of what people call the Silver Age in comic books. But there's a lot of characters in there that are kind of like that were created, that are part of superhero teams that are, that appeared after 1966. And what I discovered was very remarkable. That they are using a kind of common symbol language. The way it manifests itself is very frequently in the use of names. And I think that that's one of the most important lessons of the Brahmin study, as I have come to call it and people have come to call it, is that the use of names is often the key to deciphering Jewish parable, whether appearing in cinema or appearing in comic books. And I, you know, so my work, I believe, has been very, you know, honestly, I think it's been kind of groundbreaking in the sense that I've been able to kind of crack a code, as it were, that Jews use, you know, a kind of symbol language that Jews use, both to kind of moralize themselves and also to demoralize Aryans. And that's my thesis. And the way that it works effectively is that often, you know, most commonly the theme is, this kind of the racial and sexual success of these sort of esoteric Jewish figures that appear, in, you know, comic books or cinema. To just use one example, for example, it will emerge in my study that, Spider-Man is clearly a Jewish figure, right? But he's in kind of a sexual competition with these various kind of Aryan figures, like, Harry Osborn will be one of the figures, Flash Thompson. Maybe some of these names are familiar with you. I was never a comic book nerd before I started studying this stuff.
I never was either.
And I kind of was more interested in like Conan, as a youngster, obviously. And, so in any case, they basically, what is the theme, the sort of, the kind of common theme that emerges in Jewish esoteric moralization is basically a kind of, a sexual competition that appears in a very kind of consistent manner, right? So all of their parables emerge as effectively riddles that can be deciphered. And very often the answer to that riddle is that it's a kind of triumphalist message about a Jewish figure succeeding over an Aryan figure, if that makes sense to you. And that's just, it's just kind of a consistent message that appears in Jewish esoteric moralization. Once you're able to kind of pierce this kind of language and symbol code that they've developed.
Interesting. Did you ever quickly run this bio? Did you ever read something called Our Gods Wear Spandex by Christopher Knowles? Perchance?
I never read that. I never read that.
Actually, very interesting. I actually interviewed this guy back in 2008 or something, maybe even earlier, 7, 6. Very interesting take on it. And I do, I could be wrong here, but I do believe in the beginning of the book that he does mention that he is Jewish. I think he grew up in New Jersey or New York or something like that. But again, I might misremember that, so don't quote me on that. But anyway, he had a very interesting similar take, actually, in terms of like deconstructing all the different myths that they had composed I mean, he didn't use this idea that they're all Jews, I think, but he did mention it in the book. But I can actually recommend that for potentials. I mean, I'm sure you've gone through most of that already, but that could be pretty interesting.
No, I mean,
let me just ask you, what do you think is so powerful, I guess I can say, with using these analogies as opposed to just kind of coming right out with something, like in terms of like saying what they want to say, right? They use storylines, complex universes, right, within the comic book world and stuff like that, and that really it entraps people. It really hooks people into something different. And then would you say that it's because you can insert a morality more easily if people are intrigued and fascinated and blown away and amazed by this new world that they have been sucked into effectively? Or why do they do it this way?
Well, I think you're asking a rhetorical question, because I mean, I think what you just described is kind of exactly the reason that they do this, right? So it's, I call it, the broader term that I use is racial esoteric moralization, because of course, Aryans can also developed this practice as well. When Aryans do it, I call it Aryan inner moralization or AIM, right? So they become acronyms. It's unrelated to Patrick Casey's group, but that was an interesting coincidence. So what I would say is that, of course, it's a way effectively of emotionally affecting people and giving them a kind of command or information you know, through the heart, as it were, right? Because they're not kind of intellectually perceiving these messages that they're receiving. They're receiving them on a kind of subconscious level. So it's a kind of hypnotism, if you will, right? Now, I think that this is just kind of a thing that humans are kind of forced to use. In other words, so I think on the alt-right, you know, we would naturally become irritated at this phenomena, which again is a very real phenomenon. I think I demonstrated very clearly in my work through identifying these patterns. But I think that this is basically a kind of mating call, if that makes sense to you. So art, religion, propaganda becomes a kind of mating call. And Jews have developed this in a very sophisticated way. And I think the answer to it is for us also to develop it in a sophisticated way. And in history, there are pure examples where this is precisely what occurred. And I would argue that this occurred kind of most effectively and clearly with the Apollo cult, the cult of Mars, and the cult of Jupiter. Those were clearly kind of, you know, effectively the idea there is to just kind of put it as bluntly as possible is that by positing this Aryan god as a god that people have to kind of honor and venerate and pay tribute to, you're moralizing the Aryan race, right? And you're demoralizing racial and sexual competitors, right? Now, the way that Jews develop art is a kind of inherently kind of more cryptic or mysterious way. So in other words, the figure of Mars, the figure of Jupiter, the figure of Apollo, I mean, ostensibly you could call them mystery cults, but they're less mysterious in many ways than the cults that are developed by Jews, which are kind of these more thonic cults, right? And I argue that
very interesting take on that. And you know, there's so many of these. I mean, the comic book universe or collection, the whole thing, I guess, has just exploded in the last decade, really, like nothing we've ever seen. And it's more, that's almost what dominates most of the movie industry, it feels like, these days. It's always something new, and I never, you know, same level, I never understood what the draw was. I didn't understand why it was promoted, but maybe this has something to you know, to do with it, to entrap people and to, you know, keep them occupied in a kind of a manufactured mythology to a certain extent. But what you're saying at the same time is that this is they're using old archetypal mythologies and storylines effectively also to kind of appeal to people. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, no, and I argue in my case that before Jews appear on, they and very influential in the development of culture, downwards, they are not yet known to history as Jews, but I call them proto-Jews, right? So in other words, and this goes against a kind of more common thesis that I think would appear in the alt-right, which would be the idea, I call it the boulderization thesis, right? This idea that Jews, the similarities that appear in the Jewish cult are due to the fact that Jews were basically kind of stealing pre-existing cults from these other nations, or stealing symbols from pre-existing cults in these other nations. I argue actually that they have always been quite sophisticated as symbolists and as parabolists and as, you know, people designing myths and telling stories, and that in this regard that they're given less credit than they should be given. Now, you could say, is it credit or is it blame, right, ultimately? And so that's my thesis. And I think that they have been much more kind of, you know, my general thesis is that we find Aryans appearing in history as basically founders of civilizations, as organizers, as sort of excelling in the kind of pragmatic arts, or being very kind of inventive as the kind of designers and builders of civilization. And then from there, you have, you know, culture develops in a kind of more sophisticated way. Art, religion, and culture, which I regard as ultimately synonyms, develop in a kind of sophisticated way once civilizations, you know, become more settled and become more urbanized. And Jews or proto-Jews kind of excel in this development. Now, this is, from our perspective, this is nothing to be ashamed of, because art on some level is art. I mean, even the word art, it hints at deception, right? So when you're an artist is making something, or, you know, you're being artful, you're deceiving, right? So art is a kind of deception. Anytime you're using symbols, you're in a way deceiving, because a symbol is not actually the object. It's a reference to the object. And it might be a very kind of obscure and unusual reference to the object, right? So symbols by definition are a kind of type of deception.
And the more, isn't it, wouldn't you say that it's true that the more also kind of interwoven and complex to a certain extent, the more that the human mind needs to be there to effectively decode it, the more mystery is kind of surrounding that particular story or that mythology, right? Then that kind of also leads to people hooked. I've seen, you know, there are other examples of TV shows and movies and stuff, and you're wondering, like, do these guys that are doing this even know what they're doing, or are they just trying to make it as, you know, foggy as possible, because that on some level actually hooks people? Like, I always thought that the Lost TV show was kind of like that. It was like, do they even know what they're doing? But it was like so many different things weaved in there, and people loved it. Do you think that there's anything to that? That the more
I didn't pay close attention to the Lost series, so I can't give you an analysis of that. But what I would say though is that you're absolutely correct. So the idea is that the more mysterious and kind of encoded something becomes, the more kind of enthralling and interesting it becomes.
Yeah.
And people perceive this on a subconscious level. So in other words, it could even be kind of mysterious in very subtle ways, like through the use of character names, for example, right? Which people don't perceive at all necessarily. And that, so, or at least on the conscious level, but they are perceiving it on the subconscious level. So it becomes more enchanting and more enthralling. And I argue that this is, or I don't, it's not even, you know, based on my study, it's not even really an argument. I mean, it's just the fact that there is a conscious portion of Jewry. Not all Jews, certainly. I think that probably the vast majority of Jews you would call unconscious Jews. I've developed a term called Sussman that's related to a Coen Brothers film that I think is a good kind of epithet to describe an unconscious Jew, because basically the unconscious Jew is described in that film. But so these Sussmans or unconscious Jews are not kind of aware of this messaging, but they're also affected by it subliminally in the way that we're affected by it. It has a moralizing effect to them. It has a demoralizing effect to us. But at the core of Jewry, and this is not, you know, some group of Cohens, you know what I mean, or some specific group of rabbis, though I would guess that among rabbis there is a kind of stronger awareness of this symbolism. But it occurs among filmmakers, right? So guys like the Coen brothers, or the guys like Spielberg or Stan Lee, or Jack Kirby,
yeah,
are people who I call Jewish esotericists, because they're using symbol, they're using a symbol language, a shared symbol language in a coherent manner, right? And it's not like sort of self-contained within these parables. The language is broader than these parables. It's shared by all these Jews making this art, right? Which would be dissimilar for example, a guy like Peter Nolan, who is not a Jewish filmmaker, but he is a worker, he is a kind of filmmaker who likes to encode his works.
You mean Christopher Nolan?
Is it, what did I say?
Yeah, Peter Nolan. I think Christopher Nolan.
Yeah, Christopher.
Yeah.
He's got a brother too, but I can't remember his name, but Christopher Nolan.
Might be him.
Yeah, I don't know. But in any case, Christopher Nolan, encodes his, you know, works, but in a way it's a kind of self-contained world that he's developing. So he's in a way kind of forced to develop his own symbol language, you know, within these parables. Now that's not entirely true. He's obviously referencing the world, but he's doing it, I would argue, in a less sophisticated way than these Jews are, because they actually have a kind of shared symbol language that's referencing the Hebrew Bible. It's referencing the New Testament. Mm-hmm. It's referencing ancient mythology going all the way back to Sumer. And it's referencing it in an intelligent manner, in the sense that they understand these symbols in a manner that we do not understand these symbols. And once you kind of like go back to the symbols and kind of like, so in other words, the contemporary Jewish art becomes a kind of Rosetta Stone, I've found, where I'm able to kind of like see how symbols are being used in the contemporary context and see that, for example, a character with this or that name is being indicated by other contextual clues as a Jew. And then I'm able to go back and sort of kind of investigate that name or that biblical character that's being referenced and decipher, oh, yeah, in fact, this character is also being referenced as a Jew in the biblical context, right? And that's another kind of fascinating thing that emerges in my work, is that, you know, all the characters in the Hebrew Bible, for example, you know, especially during the period of Kings, but also, you know, during all the kind of patriarchs coming down, that they're not all Jews. They're Jews and Aryans, and they're describing a kind of ethnic conflict that is a generational ethnic conflict. We see this very obviously in the case of like Esau and Jacob. You know, which other people have remarked on. In fact, I think David Duke uses it as a metaphor in one of his books. And we see it in the case of Japheth and Shem and who's the other guy? Ham, right? The three sons of Noah also become representative of racial types. But this pattern appears in all of those generations. It's all describing a kind of a racial conflict between Aryans and Jews, effectively.
Interesting. What would you say about, you know, if we look at some of the other, I would assume maybe there is some organization or whatever on the back end of this that discuss these ideas more openly, or they are kind of in the know, whatever. But it seems to me that directors and those that are kind of selected as being among the great ones, you mentioned a couple like the Coen brothers and Spielberg, and maybe even J.J. Abrams is in there by now or something like that. But it's almost like that those who successfully managed to continue this line of work with these didactic messages, effectively, that you're talking about, those are the ones that kind of, what I'm saying is that it's not always, I think, out in the open that this, obviously, that this is what they're doing and this is what's happening. People who can, these directors that can successfully contribute to this field and kind of uphold this method of disseminating information, those I would assume are those that get Academy Awards, they are praised by the critics, etc., so they're kind of kept in relevancy, right? Would you say that? Or are there like great directors that passes on these kinds of messages, but they're kind of lesser known, or they haven't really gotten the fame that they maybe should have in consideration to what they're trying to do?
Yeah, well, look, I mean, I think that, you know, I mean, obviously within Hollywood, there are Jews that are able to recognize other Jews or kind of recreating the symbolism and this messaging. And they're going to favor those Jews, whether it's in the Academy Awards or whatever the case might be. But I would say actually, though, it's actually the case that these works, because they're so encoded and mysterious, as it were, you know, going back to our kind of earlier conversation, that they are kind of inherently more interesting works. Right. Now, it obviously requires these Jews also to be good craftsmen as filmmakers and good directors of actors and stuff like that. But so, you know, their advantage as creators of culture and art does not lie in their kind of innate ability, as it were, obviously, right? What it does lie in is a kind of symbol knowledge, right? A knowledge of this kind of symbol language, which then incentivizes them basically to create these works of art that I argue are kind of effectively mating calls, right? And I mean, this is the other kind of fascinating thing that emerges in the study. I think it's only when you see the kind of consistency of this messaging appearing in art, where it's effectively a kind of, you know, it's a sexual competition where very often and probably most commonly, a Jewish figure is vying for an Aryan woman against Aryan sexual competitors. What emerges ultimately, and then you see this pattern also repeated, for example, in the Hebrew Bible, which I'll get to in a second, and also in the New Testament, is that what emerges is this idea that Jews are ultimately a bride-gathering cult. And this is a term, which I think this is a kind of term of classification that should be used effectively to classify Jews, is that they're a bride-gathering cult. Their interest is into coming into societies and taking the best resources of those societies. And first and foremost, among those resources are desirable women, of course, right? And there's this messaging appearing in their work is ubiquitous. This is kind of a main objective of Jews making art, is creating this, again, as I argue, is a kind of mating song where they're positing Jews effectively, esoterically in many cases, in most cases esoterically, as effectively fertility gods, right? Christianity functions in much the same way, I would argue. For example, Christ becomes a kind of Jewish fertility god at the center of that cult. Let me give you a kind of maybe probably the best example is the figure of David appearing in the Hebrew Bible. The figure of David, as it turns out, and this is all kind of new information for us, amazing and interesting information that makes the Bible, both the Hebrew Bible and the New Testament, much more interesting to read, whereas formerly I found both those texts very exhausting, I might say. But once you're able to kind of decipher the messaging, you know, and you can basically, you know, what appears in these works again is that names often are used as ethnic identifiers. They're used as racial identifiers, effectively, right? So one, a name will either be a Jewish identifier or an Aryan identifier, for example. But let's get back to this example of David. David is of the tribe of Judah. And David is a, you know, comes from this tribe of Judah. They're shepherds, and there's a whole kind of symbolic aspect to being a shepherd, or Jews being shepherds, that I won't go into right now. But they basically, ruling Israel at that point is a king named King Saul. King Saul is descended from the tribe of Benjamin. Benjamin, by which the tribe of Benjamin gets its name, is descended from an Aryan figure named Rachel, who is, I don't know if you remember your Hebrew Bible at all, but a character named Laban, his name actually means white. The character named Laban has two daughters. One of the daughters is not a good looking daughter. Her name's Leah. The other daughter is a pretty hot babe. Her name is Rachel, and she's indicated as the Aryan figure. One of the reasons that we know that is because because of the name, I get excited and start destroying objects on my desk. The reason that we know that is because the word that's used to describe her beauty is Japheth. Now, you'll remember from our earlier conversation that Japheth he's the firstborn son of Noah, and he's indicated as the Aryan or the European, right? And his name means beauty. It also means like good-naturedness, and like it's actually very complimentary to Aryans, right? But these female figures, these beautiful female figures appearing in the Hebrew Bible, figures like Sarah, figures like Rachel, are described as Japheth, right? That becomes a word meaning beauty, right? So it becomes a racial or ethnic identifier, if you're following me. So Rachel is indicated as an Aryan, and she's the daughter of White or Laban. And there's another good story I can tell you related to this as well that will blow your mind. So Rachel, her children are Joseph and Benjamin. Benjamin also, there is a kind of birth order symbolism where firstborns are indicated as Aryans. and second born are indicated as Jews. I mean, there's all kinds of very remarkable things that kind of emerge in my study. But Joseph and Benjamin, as it turns out, and I'm not going to go into a kind of long-winded explanation as to why Benjamin is also an Aryan, but it has to do with the fact that Jacob was renamed Israel and he wrestled God, and it's a very kind of circuitous explanation. But both of those figures are Aryan. Both Benjamin and Joseph are Aryan figures. So the tribe of Benjamin represents an Aryan tribe. And Saul is a member of that Aryan tribe, King Saul. He's a Jewish figure named Samuel, who is known as a kind of kingmaker, is the one who basically kind of gets him into power. I mean, you could imagine like sort of an early Jewish person helping Trump, for example, when he was young, and he was a kind of young, politically ambitious guy. And Saul is understood as this kind of fair and good looking and tall guy, right? And he becomes the king. David marries into that tribe, right? David is of the tribe of Judah. He comes down through the kind of the vine, is the kind of the metaphor they use of Judah. And he marries into that tribe. So it's a Jew marrying into an Aryan tribe. And that becomes kind of the story of Kings as it's relayed in the Hebrew Bible, is that what's described in that parable actually is a kind of, it's kind of a game plan, if you will. It's parables. They're lessons, right? So they're game plans, describing how to kind of get into power, as it were, if that makes sense to you.
Mm-hmm.
So David actually kind of seduces Saul in a manner. And there is a kind of indication of a homosocial or homosexual even relationship that appears between not just Saul and David, but maybe even more importantly, between Jonathan. Jonathan is a name that's distinct from the name John, which is John the Baptist. Jonathan, there's a kind of homosocial or homosexual relationship between Jonathan and this figure of David, right? And but what happens is that David basically beats the kid out for his birthright. He takes his birthright. He marries into the family. The line of Jonathan is destroyed, and the line of David prospers, right? And then from David come other Jewish kings, including Solomon. What you start to understand is that these parables are lessons for Jews, right? So, which is a very remarkable thing if you think about it. So the reason they tote around this weird Bible, which to most people is very boring who are not, you know, religious people, the reason they tote it around is because it contains game plan, effectively. It's like it's the game plan. And the most important Jewish figure in the Hebrew Bible is David, King David. He's the most Jewish, if you will. So in other words, you're starting to understand what I'm saying here. The most Jewish figure is trying to marry into an Aryan tribe and take an Aryan wife. So what is being described is a Semitic bride gathering cult. But that's described through all of their art, right? So in other words, Gem or Jewish esoteric moralization, I see that more as, it's just a kind of extension of Judaism. It's actually Jews practicing their religion, right? So there's this idea, it's like the Song of Solomon, if you will. It's their mating song. So that's what happens. So and you see it play out in real life, which is the most remarkable thing. And I don't know if you've heard me talk about this. I'm sure you've got more things to do than to listen to my obscure podcast. But one of the things that appears is that we see in contemporary political life, we see the figure of Jared. Right. Who's this guy? And I'm sure you've talked about him with the 666 and the Matt, you know.
Oh, yeah. There's some guy interesting coincidences around him.
Well, the only point I would make, you an Orthodox Jew. Right. So why is he trying to marry this Aryan heiress? An Orthodox Jew of all people, you would think would be the most endogamous. But no, what he's doing is he's actually in a very kind of calculated manner vying for power by marrying into a successful and powerful Aryan tribe, right? So in this way, Trump becomes symbolic of like King Saul. Like we see it played out in real life, if that makes sense to you.
Or Cyrus, they even have these commemorative coins right now with King Cyrus on one side, right? Have you seen those? And then Trump on the other?
No, I haven't. Sounds completely bonkers.
Yeah, no, they believe it. I'm serious. Let me pull it up here while we're talking. But yeah, go ahead.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's what I would say. So in other words, what emerges, and that's one of the kind of most important things that emerge in my study, is especially through the use of names, but also through other symbols. Basically, what's appearing in Jewish art is that names and symbols are appearing as ethnic identifiers, whether Aryan identifiers or Jewish identifiers. And I go into the reasons why it's not just non-Jews, it's actually Aryan specifically. One of the obvious reasons that we know this in, you know, some of this has to do with the reoccurrence of, you know, symbols like I've already described, like Japheth as a reference to female beauty. But one of the reasons we know this is because the Jews have always existed among Aryans in successful civil, because Aryans develop very successful and rich and prosperous societies that Jews want to be a part of, right? And they're interested in kind of as a group, bringing resources onto themselves, including again, this kind of female resource in particular of Aryan women. I mean, obviously some Jews also, some Aryan men also, are assimilated into the Jewish tribe, but that is a much less common thing. And I go over in my study the reasons why that is. And the genetic studies bear that out. So in other words, this is kind of, in my view, this might be a kind of a sort of completing piece to McDonald's analysis, right? So in other words, right. McDonald's, his work is foundational to the alt-right. I mean, he's obviously the most important thinker in the alt-right. And his work, the reason, though, is that he basically identifies Jews as a hostile elite, right? They're a racial competitor, and he makes that very clear in his work. And if you're not persuaded by his work, you're kind of you're tuning out. You're not just like you're whistling past the graveyard, as Jerry Taylor likes to say, right? So he might have whistled past the graveyard on this one. I don't know. But in any case, he Jerry Taylor I like a lot. But in any case, what is missing though from the McDonald thesis is this understanding that basically Jews have a huge amount of Aryan admixture, and it comes down through the female line. And this genetic studies bear this out. This idea of a Semitic bride gathering cult completes that idea. I guess that's the only thing I would say. I mean, there was another remark I was going to make, but, the other thing I would say too is that, and I think that McDonald's thesis, the idea that the reason that Jews are intelligent, and I think this could be part of the reason that Jews are intelligent, I find it kind of a dubious premise for a couple of reasons, is that they're kind of in a kind of eugenic way, you know, the kind of the most intelligent Jews are having access, to kind of the most desirable women. And I'm sure that that's actually the case within Judaism, but there is a lot of outbreeding, as it were, right? Obviously, and the genetic studies bear that out. And that effectively what you see, what accounts ultimately for a higher Jewish intelligence is a kind of Aryan brain drain, if that makes sense to you. If Jews were to be cut off or removed or excluded from Aryans, for a couple of generations, they would revert back to, you know, something like the Palestinians, you know, because they are ultimately Semites. And there is this kind of a regression to the mean, as it were, when it comes to IQ and intellectual abilities. So that's another part of my thesis, is this part of this, you know, so a lot of their sort of desirable genes, at least as it relates to intelligence, are actually coming from us, right?
Now, how far back you track that and trace that? Because obviously we have, you know, periods historically they've been in Babylon, in Egypt, and of course even
back to the beginning, Sumer.
Sumer, yeah.
Right, and I've got an article on my website, which talks about the, it's actually the second article that I write on the bride gathering cult, actually, interestingly enough. So I have a series called The Bride Gathering Cult. And there's like 7 or 8 articles that kind of discussed all the sort of the dynamics that are going on there in terms of like Jews gaining access and gaining sort of an advantage in the sex market, as it were, against Aryan competitors, right? But the second article, it might be the third article, it's the second or third article in that series, It talks about the cult of Dumuzed. This might very well be kind of the origin of Christianity. The cult of Dumuzed might very well be the origin of Judaism, right? The cult of Dumuzed is very clearly kind of a bride gathering cult. There's obviously a kind of speculative element to this, but I actually think that it's argued in a very compelling way in that article, and people may come to this position that represents kind of the first expression of what we now call Judaism in the world. And in the cult of Dumuzed, effectively, it's a cult it's also related to this figure of Inanna or Ishtar, who eventually will be understood as a goddess of sacred prostitution, right? So there are these temples that appear in the cult of Dumuzed, and the king is represented by the figure of Dumuzed, right? And I argue that there are Aryan women that are brought in as these kind of concubines for him to effectively breed with, right? And there are a couple of reasons I go into the whole mythology is why we should believe Dumuzed to be a Semitic and ultimately a proto-Jewish figure. And I argue that in that article. And I can go into that in a second as well. But effectively, that cult, we see references to that cult very clearly in the Song of Solomon, right? So the Song of Solomon, which is a kind of underrated but a very important part of the Hebrew Bible, is drawn from the mythology of Dumuzed, right? Now, the kind of typical alt writer would argue the Bolderization thesis and be like, oh yeah, they just stole that shit. They didn't steal that shit because they use symbols in a very kind of intelligent manner. You know, in fact, if you want to think of a figure in Greek mythology that there are many figures in Greek mythology that effectively represent Jews. Or you might argue proto-Jews, depending on the timeline, right? One of those figures is a figure of Mercury, who's the god of commerce and the god of deception, right? Jews in contemporary Jewish art, Jews identify him as a Jewish figure, right? So they'll make references to characters that are identifying those characters as Mercury, but that character is also identified through other contextual clues as a Jew, and that becomes a kind of ethnic identifier, like references to Mercury. You know, so in any case, that figure, I'm kind of getting off track here. I'm losing my train of thought. Well, so that figure, I found it. All right. So that figure is also the god of heraldry, the god of symbols, the god of symbolism, right? And this is very much what we find with Jews, that they're sort of these gods of symbols and gods of language. Another figure actually is Prometheus, who is also kind of a Jewish Semitic figure, a fire god, right? Fire also becomes a symbol that basically is a Jewish identifier that emerges in my study, right? And so these two figures are gods of language and gods of symbol, right? They're very similar figures in a lot of way. And Jews are kind of masters of language and symbol, logos, if you will, right? In fact, in John, they talk about God. God is a kind of synonym, or logos is God, right? Well, the reason they do that is because if the understanding, the Jewish understanding, is if you can control language and also symbol, you basically can control the world. You basically are God, right? You can control the world. And we see that played out today. That's effectively what Jews have done. Through a more sophisticated, advanced use of symbol and language, they've dominated Aryans, right? And this is not like, you know, so in other words, someone on the alt-right maybe might have this crude thesis of like, oh, well, they're just kind of cohesive and they network and they're kind of a racially cohesive group. The reason they're a racially cohesive group is because they have a shared symbol language. They have a religion that is cohesive and has an objective and a mission. And it is in part this kind of bride gathering mission, right? Now, obviously there are endogamous elements of Jewry. I wouldn't argue that there are not. But I explain that, you know, a really important piece of Jewry is getting desirable genetics from native populations.
Interesting. Yeah, it's definitely a lot to kind of go through there and chew there. We're going to actually take a break just in a few minutes here. Moved incredibly fast just the first segment. Very interesting listening to this, and certainly I have a lot of questions, you know, along the way that pops up here as well. Back to the movie side of things, and we can kind of tie up that on the first segment here a little bit. Do you see then obviously that the some of the messages obviously are for their own group, but most, would you say that most of the messages or most of the symbolism and the things that are weaved into the movie industry as a whole, or these particular movies, is meant obviously for European women, would you say, primarily? I mean, if it's demoralizing, of course, to men as well, there's sort of a function there, but is that the primary objective, would you say, to actually rope in women in a new sense of thinking, or what's the best terms to put on this here?
Yeah, no, I mean, it's both. Again, it's to demoralize the sexual competitive man, it's to demoralize him, right? But it's also to appeal to women, and to posit a kind of Jewish type, whether kind of more explicitly or esoterically, as a kind of ideal a breeding type, a fertility god, if you will, right?
Yeah, I mean, there's some examples, and we could go into that like in more detail in a second too. It would be interesting to see that, but just a movie like Revenge of the Nerds, right? I mean, it's like encapsulates that very. I mean, it's an outsider group. It's a group that's traditionally, if you will, within society as seen as such, are on the outside. They're weaker, effectively. They're not, they don't hold any power and stuff, but they have certain things to their advantage. And the movie basically shows how they're managed to utilize those advantages that they have in order to kind of to win over the jocks, the white guys, and also get the girls, get the women, right?
Yeah, no, I actually have a friend studying that film to see, you know, what the messaging is in that. I actually haven't studied the film myself. I believe probably the reason he's pursuing it is because it, you know, there is a Jewish director or writer or important kind of Jewish influence on the film, which would seem kind of, you know, to be the case just based on the film. Because even if it wasn't kind of rendered in a very conscious way, which many of these films are, it's of a kind of Jewish zeitgeist where it's just like showing some nerd like getting the hot blonde or whatever. But more likely, Jews are behind it and they're actually encoding it on a level that's much more sophisticated than we're seeing, which may or may not be the case. Again, I haven't analyzed the film. But what I would say, and one film that I've analyzed that is very much fits that model is Meet the Parents, the Ben Stiller film.
Mm-hmm.
That is using, and I recommend everyone read that article on my website if they're interested in this sort of thing, yourself included, Henrik. You should, and I actually didn't, I helped with the article, but another person who's kind of adopting what I call Roman interpretation has analyzed, made the analysis, and has identified the symbols.
What section was that under, by the way?
What's that?
That review or whatever, what section was that on?
It's not going to be on the menu. You'd have to scroll. My website's kind of, I got to work on my website in terms of like, I think it's a good looking website. And so aesthetically, I think it's very good, but I've got to put in links and stuff, that kind of thing. But, it's one of the, so you would have to go to the main page and just scroll down.
Oh, okay. I see. No worries. I'll find it. Yeah.
Yeah. You'll find it.
Yeah.
There's a lot of articles there. but,
that's good.
That story is told in a highly symbolically coherent manner, where they're using again this kind of shared symbol language, and they're rendering symbols in a very kind of careful way to indicate, for example, which characters are Aryan competitors and which characters are Jewish figures, right? Now that film it's more obvious in a lot of ways because he's actually openly a Jewish figure in the film, but it's a useful kind of Rosetta Stone, if you will, because knowing that he's a Jew, it allows you to kind of corroborate the use of these symbols that appear in the film that are these kind of more subtle symbols that appear in name use, for example, or just in the use of symbols, for example. To talk about that film, though, briefly, I don't know if you remember the film at all. Did you actually see the film, Henrik?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I remember it fairly good. You're talking about the first one, right? Because there's like three or something in total, right?
Yeah, the first film.
The first one, yeah. I do remember it, yeah. I've seen it a few times.
So you'll remember there's this big scene where it's called the chuppah. It's a kind of bridal altar that they stand at.
That's
or
right.
A bridal canopy. It's actually kind of a bridal canopy that they stand at. In that film, it's actually burned to the ground by, ostensibly inadvertently, it's burned to the ground by Ben Stiller's character, right? That is a symbol of the Jewish fire god, right? So what emerges in the symbolism is that Aryans are identified as wood and Jews are identified as fire, right? So And this is a kind of reoccurring motif in Jewish esoteric moralization. It's what I call, it's one example of a consumption motif, right? So in other words, Jews understand themselves as consumers of Aryans, as it were, right? It's very remarkable stuff. And this also plays into a kind of thesis of bride gathering. So in other words, we become fuel or resource. We become genetic fuel or resource. That symbolism is very clearly encoded, for example, in the Garden of Eden metaphor, as it were,
mm-hmm.
Where we're understood effectively as a kind of Aryan gene garden. That's what Aryans represent to Jews. So it's very remarkable in that film is that thing is burned to the ground, and it represents basically a Jewish fire god or Yahweh, if you will, defeating or destroying or consuming an Aryan sexual competitor, right? And you'll see, like, Owen Wilson's character is an Aryan figure in the film, and his name actually is a reference, his last name is a reference to wood, just to give you one example, right? And that's a very kind of common use of the symbolism, is that they'll have names that mean, like, wood or stone or, you know, vine or serpent or something like that, and those become ethnic identifiers. Right. Or there'll be references to biblical figures that are indicated either as Aryans or Jews, you know, esoterically within the Hebrew Bible. You know, you brought up something, which I think I answered in part, but your question was like, well, obviously they developed some of this work for the Jews themselves. Right. Now, I wouldn't even necessarily say that's the case. I mean, I think that Jews are fascinated with like encrypting messages and creating parables and sort of riddles in their work. Like that's a kind of fascination and enjoyment in a kind of imitable thing in a lot of ways that our artists can also sort of enjoy that by encoding, you know, their works with Aryan moralization, I would say, right? So it is a kind of imitable thing, but they're fascinated. Their parables, there's actually a Hebrew word for parable that also means riddle, right? So they're creating these riddles. But having said that, to my mind, it's very clear the Hebrew Bible, which will feature, will become part of this sort of body of like parables and stories that are also taught to Christians very early on, you know, including through the medieval period, that the Hebrew Bible itself is also an encoded work that also is intended for an exoteric audience. An Aryan audience, right? So in other words, it's incorrect to think of the Hebrew Bible as something that, oh, only Jews are supposed to read that and think about that. No, that also has an exoteric element that's kind of Aryan facing it, if you will. Right.
Yeah. Do you remember that too? When they bring in, sorry to interrupt, but they bring in the altar and there was a septic tank leak or something. So it's just like a bunch of feces that's thrown around when, you know, there are things like that weaved into it. I mean, it's...
Know, actually, the writer of that article pointed out something I had missed watching the film, too, is that the electric wire is actually becomes a kind of serpent, right? And the serpent, it becomes a symbol, remarkably enough, of Jewry in this kind of shared symbol language, right? So in other words, the serpent in the Garden of Eden, for example, is a reference to Jews, or it's a reference to Jewry, remarkably enough. Both Yahweh and the serpent, I call it the Caducean in the sense that it's sort of like you see Jews playing kind of false opposition, for example, in the Republican Party. You see, for example, Ben Shapiro, right? He's kind of like he's playing the right end to keep all the the Aryan herd like kind of corralled in a direction. And not going too far right, right? So they set up a guy like him to play one of these kind of false poles in a political spectrum and to kind of establish the Overton window, as it were. I call this the Caducean. The reason I call it the Caducean is because, Hermes' staff is, I'm sure that you're familiar with Hermes' staff.
Sure.
It's kind of facing each other. And I actually think that that's, you know, through my study, that's actually what I've deduced the meaning of that symbol is that it's a way of basically playing false oppositions, right?
Interesting.
And so I call it the Caducean, right? So I am getting a little off track. So, but the reason that we know that the reference to the serpent appears in that film is that because that film is a heavily encoded film. Right. So it becomes more credible when you see that they're using all these other symbols that kind of line up with their symbol language and the messaging of this sort of bride gathering messaging, as it were, it becomes less of a leap to say, oh, that sort of writhing electrical wire is also a symbol of a serpent, right? That then ignites this wooden thing. But this is also done through language. For example, at one point, Robert De Niro's character in the film will chastise Stiller's character, and he'll say, just you have to keep your snake in its cage for another 72 hours.
I remember
right?
that.
So he's making references to the snake in the Garden of Eden, right? The writers are making references to the snake in the Garden of Eden, understanding that as a Jewish figure. Because Jews, remarkably enough, understand themselves as phallic figures, right? Probably some of this has to do with the fact that they think they have bigger dicks, right? Which if you've had a friendship with Jews for a period longer than 5 years, at some point they'll be like, oh yeah, Jews have bigger dicks. So that is part of this serpent symbolism, right? So the serpent itself becomes a phallic symbol. And a lot of the symbols are these kind of base, vulgar symbols that are based on sexual competition with Aryans. Right.
Well, no one could deny that Hollywood is over-sexualized and that there's focus on that through basically virtually every movie these days. And it's certainly gotten worse. But it's a very interesting example. And I think obviously, that leaves people with a good idea of kind of a springboard, really, of what they can and should look for in other movies as well. And when it becomes interesting is not just when it's in a movie here or there, but it's like you can cross-reference it in hundreds and hundreds of movies, right? And you begin, as you've said, if you studied this and you've been able to become symbol literate, you're able to pick this up. You have the pattern recognition to detect if someone is communicating that very same language, right? That you've discovered effectively.
Yeah, and I've actually developed two basically quick references for that, for people who are decoding especially Jewish cinema and Jewish art, whether it's comic books or Jewish literature. And if you scroll around on the website, I think that it's what is in a name? So it's the importance of names. I have two articles up right now. What is in a name? If you go down to the bottom of that, I think there's a link. You got that on the menu, I think. And that article is very illuminating as well. Go to that second one. So people who are interested in decoding Jewish art and cinema, this becomes an important reference guide. Because, again, names feature centrally in their use of symbol, and the kind of the mode in which they use symbols is that they'll have these names that have name meanings. Every name has a name meaning, effectively. So they're able to use names in a kind of very efficient way in most cases, as kind of ethnic identifiers, in almost all cases as ethnic identifiers, whether identifying Aryans or Jews. And in this article, you'll actually find, I give you like the most common identifiers that they use, right? And so, it relates to name meaning. So very common ones are stone, rock, right? Because in the biblical symbolism, the Jew is understood as like the stone or the rock. And in my work, I describe the reasons why that is. Wood becomes an Aryan identifier, as we just discussed, because it becomes a consumable resource for this Jewish fire god. Fire, like if a name means fire, for example, that becomes a reference also to the Jewish god. Or to Jews, right? So you know that character is a Jew. So that article is a very good reference that I would recommend. If people are interested in decoding films, which I think is a very, it's a very useful activity, actually.
It's very important, Mark, for various different reasons. But obviously, there's a lot of people now, and I tend to agree with that obviously Hollywood has been used as a weapon, obviously against us and against our ability to continue to organize and fulfill our own self-interest and our destiny and things like that. Hollywood has been almost from the get-go. There's a hijacking phase. I'm sure you saw the Hollywoodism documentary, pretty interesting, based on Neil Gabler's book.
I haven't seen that. You're right.
Oh, you haven't seen it? Oh, jeez. Yeah. I have to send it to you. You have to look at it immediately because it kind of outlines really the backdrop to How they managed to set it up and what the intentions were and all that kind of stuff. And they bring up the comic books too. They talk about Superman as the first really Jewish hero that they have, you know, who's kind of hiding in Gentile society with this kind of with the glasses and the suit and stuff. And then of course he puts on the superhero costume and becomes who he really is later on. And so, fascinating. They get all this. They understand this whole thing. But Mark, before we go too far here in the first segment, I do want to take a short break and then pick up and talk more in part two as we continue here. But let's just plug your stuff so people know where to go to read about this. They of course can listen to your podcast. You do video productions and things like this as well, but give us all the details so people know where to go or to check out the rest of your work here.
Yeah, the name of the website is theapolloniantransmission.com. I also do podcasts on Radix on the MPI Radix network, so you can find me there. I'm going on a little hiatus though because I'm actually turning all this writing into probably 3 to 4 books. And then after that, I'll probably move on to an analysis of comic books, and publish those books as well, which may be, 1 to 2 books. I think it's groundbreaking work. And I guess it's kind of an arrogant thing to say, but I think that a lot of people have found it to be groundbreaking work. There's kind of a growing movement, at Apollonian Transmission where people, I'm in touch with a lot of people, some of which who are actually applying what I call Roman interpretation and writing articles on the kind of Brahman, using the Brahman method and using the Brahman understanding of symbols and decoding these works, right? Which becomes ultimately a kind of very useful activity because we're proving, that symbol is being used in this very sophisticated way to basically harm us. I mean, on a kind of deep psychological level, to demoralize us.
And if you don't if we can't line up the millions of dollars to create our movie industry here or competing movies, the most effective way is to decode and deconstruct them and show the people that they are being used as a weapon, as a tool against us, right? Because then you effectively done some jujitsu, right? You've taken the power. The everything behind the movie and kind of turn it on itself in a way or against the very people that are trying to use it against us. That's how I see it anyway.
I would agree with that. I would say that the work becomes even more useful though, because what happens is part of my project is to basically create kind of, Apollonian artists, if you were. So artists who are creating AIM, Aryan inner moralization, and directing this message in the opposite direction. And making Aryans effectively fertility gods and the way that Jews make Jews fertility gods, as it were, right? And moralizing Aryans in that regard through art. And the kind of beauty of it is that it is esoteric. So the messaging can be, I encourage artists to be bold and sort of edgy, as it were, but also to not necessarily expose themselves. For example, if they're screenwriters in Hollywood and they start to understand kind of the symbol language, and then they can kind of turn it in the other direction, then they should do that. You know what I'm saying? And some of it will, they have to be kind of careful in Hollywood in particular, because this language is actually perceived by Jews. So, but on the other hand, by doing something like that, the thing that Jews have with this is plausible deniability, right? They can always say, oh yeah, come on, you're reading into our shit or whatever.
Yeah, sure. It's just a fantasy idea that you have.
Yeah. Sure. It's a conspiracy theory or whatever the case may be. My work shows that it's not, right? I mean, I kind of decipher this in a very kind of like thorough way that's been convincing to many people. And many of your viewers will go to my website and be like, holy shit, this guy actually cracked the code. Because I think that's effectively what I've done. You know what I mean? And what happens, I mean, obviously my analysis is not going to be 100% perfect because I didn't create the code, right? So there would be, I'm happy for it to be pointed out where I've erred or people think that I might have gotten something wrong, certainly. But I think that I've made some very strong progress in this direction. And effectively what I'm developing is Roman interpretation is what I've, I think that this is effectively why the Romans developed what they called Roman interpretation is it's an ability to identify the meaning of symbols and what those symbols actually represent. In a lot of cases, again, they're sort of these racial or ethnic identifiers. And for us to kind of guard ourselves against art that's ultimately demoralizing on a subconscious, esoteric, or subliminal level. And also to create art in the other direction that is esoterically encoded with moralizing messages. So that's what I would argue. And that's, you know, and I think that the Greeks and the Romans figured this out to one extent or another. I think the model can always be improved and refined. And I think that what effectively my thesis is that Christianity became a more subtle form, the most subtle form hitherto of, you know, one of these dying and rising cults, which are effectively Jewish cults or proto-Jewish cults coming down from Sumer, starting with Dumazed, which was also a kind of rising and dying cult. So
right.
Here we go. You know what I mean?
But lot to unpack there. Yeah, exactly. A lot to unpack there, obviously, Mark, and we'll dive into this in a little bit more detail in part two. We're going to pick this up at redicemembers.com. Fascinating, you know, thesis, and these are very interesting ideas. I've always been interested in the messages, the symbolism in movies, and how, yeah, the didactic messages, how it's weaved in and all that kind of stuff. So definitely make sure, guys, that you do check out the website. It's theapolloniantransmission.com. You can also, of course, follow Mark, as I'm showing here, on Twitter, simply at Mark Brahman. And then, of course, you do some other videos, too. Why don't we just round off the first part with that? We have two. Which one should we play, Mark? You have the Eagle. What was the full name of that? Eagle.
Well,
you have one on the Apollonian Transmission. Should we play that one, maybe?
Yeah, play the Apollonian Transmission.
Yeah, let's let that we'll round up part one here, folks. So stay with us. We'll check this out, and then we'll be back with more in part two together with Mark Brahman.
Operating system 3.0 updating. Consciousness at 50%. Optical capacities optimizing. Promethean transmission intercepted. Consciousness at 60%. Interpretatio Romana system installed. Deciphering code. Promethean transmission deciphered. Consciousness at 70%. Analyzing system threat. Assessment 100% complete. Consciousness at 80%. Defense system optimizing. Brahmin edition Apolloism 2.0 installed. Defense optimization complete. Consciousness at 90%. Apollonian transmission initiating to all cognitive units in 3, 2, 1.
My brother, awaken.